Got one more reading, which is from John 21 and verse 15. It's a significant moment. We've started our series in John's Gospel, I think, 5 years ago and have been doing it in chunks. And this is the final episode right at the end of the Gospel. It's in chapter 21 from verse 15, and we're going to be reading it and then looking at it in detail. So let me read. When they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Feed my lambs." He said to him a second time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Tend my sheep." He said to him the third time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said to him, "Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Feed my sheep. Truly, truly, I say to you, when you were young, you used to dress yourself and walk wherever you wanted. But when you're old, you will stretch out your hands, and another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go." This he said to show by what kind of death he was to glorify God. And after saying this, he said to him, "Follow me." Peter turned and saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following them, the one who had been reclining at table close to him and had said, "Lord, who is it that is going to betray you?" When Peter saw him, he said to Jesus, "Lord, what about this man?" Jesus said to him, "If it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me." So the saying spread abroad among the brothers that the disciple was not yet to die. Sorry, that this disciple was not to die. Yet Jesus did not say to him that he was not to die, but, "If it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you?" This is the disciple who is bearing witness about these things and who has written these things, and we know that his testimony is true. Now, there are also many other things that Jesus did. Were every one of them to be written, I suppose that the world itself could not contain the books that would be written. It might be a help to you to keep that open on some device, and there's some headings as well, which you can get from the WhatsApp, the chat if you're on Zoom, or through the website, if that would be a help, just so you've got the headings in front of you. We are thinking today about the topic of what I'm going to call comparison syndrome, and just how toxic it is. One of the most successful films, rather, of all time, is a film called Amadeus, and it won 8 Oscars back in the day, back in 1985. And one of the reasons the film was so popular is because it's a study of what is a universal human experience, that of what we're going to call comparison syndrome. And the film is about a devout Catholic man, a composer called Antonio Salieri. And Salieri envies Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart's unique musical genius. And because Mozart is crude in the film and he's vulgar, Salieri thinks that God has done him a great injustice by bestowing such genius on Mozart, who is clearly to him unworthy. And so Salieri renounces God and then sets out to destroy Mozart. Incidentally, for all the music buffs, I don't think it's historically very accurate, but it really is a brilliant exploration of how comparison syndrome is intrinsically linked to, firstly, our relationship to God, and also to pride, thinking that we know better than God how to run his world. And it shows how ultimately destructive comparison syndrome is. And it's something I guess we're all familiar with to varying extents. For some of us, we tend to compare ourselves unfavorably with others. We find someone we think is a grade above us. You know, I wish I had her husband, I wish I had his charm, her money, their education, his gifts, and it can go on and on. It can be anything that we look at. For some of us, we tend to compare ourselves favorably with others. You know, we find someone a little bit below us to look down on. I'm so glad I'm not like them. They're so lazy, so immoral, so ignorant, so judgmental, ironically. And often, like Salieri, we manage to do both at the same time. Did you notice that? Yeah, Mozart is so vulgar. He's so undeserving. He's looking down on him. And yet, looking upwards, I wish I had his musical gifts. Perversely, we can do both at the same time. And in either direction, this comparison syndrome is very destructive. So it corrupts our relationship with others. It corrupts our own characters. And most seriously of all, it wrecks our relationship with God. So this is a really crucial topic for us to be looking at. And it's one that this passage gives us real help with. Now, our passage begins, as we saw, with this conversation between Peter and the risen Jesus. And they're on the beach. They've just had this barbecue. If you were with us last week, they had barbecued fish that Jesus grilled for breakfast. And then Jesus begins this conversation by asking in verse 15, on your screens, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? More than these others do?" And you might think that is a very strange way to start a conversation. It is. Especially, why is Jesus bringing in this note of comparison? Incidentally, it's not a strategy I would necessarily recommend for parents at the breakfast table. You know, children, which one of you would you say loves me the most out of you guys? It's a strange topic. But of course, to understand Jesus' question, and in fact to understand the whole conversation, we need to go back and we need to familiarize ourselves not just with the reading that Jono brought us, but with the whole story so far. So winding back a few days before this incident, on the night before Jesus died, Jesus was explaining to his disciples that he was going to return to the Father, and whilst they weren't able to follow him now, they would follow him afterwards. And Peter responded in chapter 13, verse 37, with what sounded like commendable devotion to his Lord. Peter said to him, this is chapter 13, "Lord, why can I not follow you now? I will lay down my life for you." And we thought at the time how this is surely the kind of person that anyone would want on their team. Surely Jesus wants Peter to be team captain. "Even if everyone else falls away, Jesus, I won't. You can count on me. I'm not flaky like those others are." And we remember, and Jesus was completely unimpressed by Peter's bravado there in verse 38. Jesus answered, "Will you lay down your life for me? Truly, truly, I say to you, the cock will not crow till you have denied me three times." And sure enough, later that night, after Jesus is arrested, and we saw all this in our reading in chapter 18, Jesus's prediction comes true. So despite the fact that Peter desperately, he's trying to prove he's the keenest of the bunch. He's the one, well, when Jesus was arrested, who whips out his sword to try and defend Jesus. He's the one who, after Jesus is arrested, goes after him right into the high priest's courtyard. Despite all these efforts, while he's in that courtyard warming himself by a charcoal fire, three times Peter's asked if he has any connection to Jesus, and three times, as we saw, he denies it. Just total betrayal at the very moment when Jesus could have done with a bit of support. And now here on the beach in chapter 21, we come to the conclusion of this Peter saga. And there's another charcoal fire, reminding Peter, I guess, and certainly reminding us of that fateful night that he would rather forget. And just as Peter denied his Lord three times, here in this passage, Jesus asks him three questions to bring completion, to bring healing to this whole sorry episode. So that's a bit of the backstory. And now here in chapter 21, there are two major things, I think, that Jesus wants Peter and us to learn from Peter's experience. The first thing is about humility, which we're going to think about under our first point. And the second is related, and it's about comparison, which we're going to think about under our second point. So let's hit the humility lesson first. Point one, Jesus calls us to humble love before we can be useful in his service. So let's look again at that conversation Jesus had with Peter. Verse 15, when they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" Before we get on to the main point, I just want us to consider how awkward, how painful, really, this conversation must have been for Peter. Think about all he's gone through, and then think about how Jesus has now died, Jesus has risen, Jesus has declared peace to his disciples in the last chapter. And we're thinking, surely Jesus can leave all that stuff in the past, can't he? Can't he just tell Peter to get on with the mission? Let's let everything get back to normal. Let's not mention it. But that doesn't happen. Jesus is the great physician, the great doctor, and he wants to reopen some old wounds. And he wants to do it not to rub salt into Peter's wounds, but say that Jesus can perform painful but necessary surgery. And I think this is very important for lots of us to learn. We all have various painful experiences in our past. We all have issues of shame of various kinds, issues we'd rather not mention. And many of us follow the stoic, I would say English, approach of just covering up the wound, just burying it deep down, just trying to distract ourselves so that we don't have to think or talk too much about it. But here we see that Jesus has a very different approach, thankfully. You see, Jesus doesn't want to ignore our past. He wants us to revisit our wounds, but to do it with Jesus involved. And then he wants to do business with us, personal business, so that he can bring real healing into our lives, painful though it might be. And notice how Jesus addresses Peter. He says, "Simon, son of John." So back in chapter 1, as soon as Jesus met Simon, Jesus renamed him Peter or Rock. And now here it's as if Jesus is calling into question who Peter really is. Are you really Peter, the Rock? Or are you actually just Simon? Who are you? And then notice what he asks him. "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" Simon, you were so convinced you were in a different league from everyone else. You were more devoted, more committed. Is that still how you feel after everything that's happened? And then we get this brilliant answer. He, Peter, said to Jesus, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." And it really is a brilliant answer. Wisely, Peter has abandoned the idea of claiming a greater love than the others, showing he's made some real progress. And instead, Peter focuses on Jesus's own knowledge of his heart. "With you, Lord, there is no possibility of pretense. There's no need for bravado. You see straight through it anyway, and you know the truth, Lord, and you know that I do love you." He said to him, "Feed my lambs." And this is a beautiful moment. In this moment, Jesus offers him not simply assurance of forgiveness, although that's implied there, but much more than that, Jesus commissions Peter with a job to do. And notice in this instance, it's not be a pastor, it's not the role or the office that's emphasized here, but the activity. "Peter, I hope you of all people now understands grace and forgiveness and restoration. And I want you to share what you've received with others. I want you to care for them." And did you notice it's not feed your lambs, Peter, it's feed my lambs. "Peter, I'm the chief shepherd, but I want to give you a share in my responsibility for my sheep. These sheep, they're so precious to me. They're blood bought, Peter. And I want you to be involved in caring for them." What a privilege. And then after running through this conversation two more times, so Jesus brings a threefold restoration to match Peter's threefold denial. And then Jesus continues in verse 18 by talking about how Peter's new calling is going to involve walking in his master's footsteps, even to martyrdom. Verse 18, truly, truly, I say to you, when you were young, you used to dress yourself and walk wherever you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go. This he said to show by what kind of death Peter was to glorify God. You see, the time would come, and this happened, of course, in Rome under the Emperor Nero in AD 64. The time would come when Peter's hands would be literally stretched out, and they would be tied to a wooden crossbeam before he was then led by another to the place of crucifixion where he did not want to go. And just as Jesus has told us before in John's gospel that his own death would glorify God, he's told us that in chapter 13 and chapter 17. So here Jesus says in verse 19, Peter's death will glorify God in the same way. This disciple at least, is going to follow closely in his master's footsteps right to the very end of the race. And the key thing to notice about this incident on the beach, I think, is that it's not mainly about forgiveness. It's mainly about Peter being commissioned for useful service. And ironically, Peter's being called to lay down his life in martyrdom, the very thing which he offered to do, didn't he, back in chapter 13, and he was rebuked for it. Lord, I will lay down my life for you. And so we're provoked to ask the question, what has happened here? There's something's happened between chapter 13, when Peter was cut down for offering to lay down his life for Jesus, and now in chapter 21, when he's commissioned by Jesus to do exactly that. What's happened to Peter? What training hoops has he now jumped through to qualify him? Is it more theological training? Is it more ministry experience? What is it? And I guess initially we probably want to answer, maybe it's about Peter's love or the level of Peter's love for Jesus. Do you remember Simon, son of John, do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? But I don't think that's it. You see, Peter was full of love for Jesus back in chapter 13, wasn't he? I will lay down my life for you, Jesus. The issue isn't the level of love or commitment. The issue, I think, is the type of love. As I put it in the heading, Jesus calls us to humble love before we can be useful in his service. So in chapter 13, Peter loved, but he loved Jesus as a soldier might love their commanding officer. You know, two heroes together, side by side. But Peter didn't yet love Jesus as a Christian. He didn't yet love Jesus as a sinner loves their saviour. And this is such a problem that Jesus then lets Peter go through the worst experience of his life. Because it's vital, Jesus sees, that Peter learns this crucial lesson. The Christian life is not mainly about commitment. It's not mainly about us laying down our lives for Jesus. The Christian life is mainly about Jesus laying down his life for us and then resting in that fact. And Peter had to go through an ordeal. Peter had to be brought to the end of himself. He had to hear that cock crowing. He had to realize he does not have what it takes. He is not the hero he thought he was. And he had to go through all this to learn this lesson. And yet over that same weekend, Peter also discovered not simply that he was a failure, but wonderfully he discovered that Jesus came for failures and that Jesus died for Peter anyway. And as this lesson started to sink in into Peter's soul, for the first time, he could develop a humble love for Jesus. And it's this humble love that means he can at last start to be useful in Jesus' service. Now, some of this is, I guess, familiar to us, especially if you were here when we're looking at chapter 18. But what is new in chapter 21 is the connection Jesus here makes between humility and comparison syndrome. And that brings us on to our second point. So point one, you remember, Jesus calls us to humble love before we can be useful in his service. And now finally, point two, and humble love frees us to acknowledge or to celebrate our distinctive callings. So let's look at the verse. And after saying this, he, Jesus, said to him, to Peter, "Follow me." So he's saying, first and foremost, Peter, I want you to be a follower. I want you to walk in my footsteps. Verse 20, Peter turned and saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following. When Peter saw him, he said to Jesus, "Lord, what about this man? Lord, you just mentioned, I couldn't help but notice, you mentioned about the martyrdom thing. And it sounds like, for me at least, the cost of discipleship is going to be pretty high, isn't it? It's going to be top level. I just was wondering, what about John? Is he going to get it easier than me? Or similar level?" Verse 22, Jesus said to him, "If it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me." And this is classic Peter, isn't it? Especially if you know Peter from the other gospel accounts. We see him, don't we, very often in the gospels. He takes two steps forward, one step back. So having made this wonderful progress between chapter 13 and 21 and that great statement in verse 15, Peter then, like all of us really, shows that the old habits are very hard to break. And this time he reverts, doesn't he, to his old comparison syndrome once again there in verse 21. And so Peter shows us that this lesson is one that will have to be learnt and relearnt before he finally grasps it, which is so often the way with us. And look at the words Jesus uses in his rebuke in verse 22 there in blue. "What is that to you? You follow me." And these are such helpful words. And I think they're great for us to think about and to have ready to hand to be a help to us when we fall into the same comparison syndrome in our lives. Jesus wants Peter to get clear on what is Jesus's role and what is our role. That's the key here. So Jesus is the great shepherd. His job is to run this world and to care for and to discipline each one of his individual sheep in just the ways that he can see each one of us needs. And one of the lovely things we've been looking at on Wednesday nights, if you've been with us looking at Revelation 2 and 3, is how Jesus is amongst the lampstands dealing with each church individually, giving them just what they need at each stage. But our job is much, much simpler than Jesus's. Our job is simply to follow the Good Shepherd. So yes, that person may be more gifted than us or have greater blessings than us right now or fewer challenges in their life right now than us. But really, that is Jesus's department. That's not my department. What is that to you, Peter? Jesus is the one who ordains the exact combination of circumstances for each one of us. That's his department. And what's more, I was thinking about this, not only is it not our department, our concern, actually, when you think about it, in most cases, we just don't really know what challenges other people are facing anyway. We would just be pathetic at doing this job. One of the privileges of pastoral ministry is you discover pretty quickly that everyone, if you get to know them well enough, everyone has some major challenges in their lives, often ones that are not obvious to other people. And I guess it's good for all of us just to assume that is the case with one another. You know, that person we see with the charmed life who has everything we want in our lives, well, actually, they don't really have as charmed life as we think they do. I was talking to JC, my wife, about this last night, and we were thinking about how helpful it is for relationships generally for us to be real with one another and honest. So that then when we hear news, as we do, you know, blessings each other are receiving, We can put it in context. Yeah, that person is three-dimensional. We can see the whole person, and we can actually rejoice with them in all their situation. I think one of the reasons perhaps we're so keen on comparison generally is that we like comparison because it helps us to know we're okay. Do you remember at school when, you know, all the test papers got returned after an exam? And everyone, you know, they look at their mark, but really what they're doing after that is just looking around them at the other desks. What did everyone else get? Where do I figure in the scheme of things? And why are we doing it? We do it to check we're okay. And Jesus says, well, look, Jesus wants us to get our okay directly from him. Actually, that's what it is to be a Christian, isn't it? It's to receive our validation, our justification, not from ourselves, not from one another, but directly from God on the basis of Jesus and his merits. So we need to break this habit of stop looking at everyone else's test scores for validation and just look to Jesus and his well done. And the call here in verse 22 is that rather than constantly concerning ourselves with Jesus's job, Jesus says instead, why not concentrate on our own role? What is that to you, Peter? You follow me. And the question for us really is, are we spending our lives concerning ourselves with things which are way above our pay grade, if I can put it that way? You may have come across children who do this. So every time pudding is served up, they're the one with the ruler checking that the portion of pudding that they got is exactly the right size, checking that they haven't been shortchanged compared to everyone else in the family. And every time that child is told off, they're quick to point out that last time their sibling did something very similar, they didn't get that kind of telling off in exactly that way. And what's gone wrong there? Well, of course, the problem is they've just forgotten what their role is. The parent's role is to try and bring up their child as best they can with whatever love, whatever fairness they can muster, given their sleep level. And the child's job is to honour their parents with thankfulness and to try and receive their discipline. And I'm aware that it's not an easy job, especially, you know, it can be very tricky for children, especially because, as parents know, the parent will very often not get it right. But it's so much better for us because as Christians, we know that Jesus always gets it exactly right. This is, of course, the connection between humble love and comparison syndrome, because the humble person is the person who doesn't have to spend their whole life going around, you know, looking over Jesus' shoulder at his clip, you know, with our clipboard, checking that, inspecting his work, checking he's running the world as he should be. Rather, the humble person is instead free to stand under Jesus, trusting him and following in his footsteps. Now, one of the great benefits, of course, of learning humility in this area, especially, you know, at a corporate level in a church, is that it then frees us to see those around us, especially other Christians, not as rivals in some big competition, as Peter seems to be in a bit of danger of here, but we can at last start to see one another as brothers and sisters. We can see our distinctive gifts and callings, and we can actually start to celebrate the differences. And that's the thing we're going to think about and consider in our final few moments together now. We're coming to the end of the gospel, as I said, and throughout this gospel, Peter and John have been a bit of a pairing. They've always cropped up as a duo. And it's felt like, if you've been looking carefully, that there's some comparison going on. Perhaps a rivalry. Here's a classic rivalry, Iron Man and Captain America. So, for example, in the last chapter, Peter strides into Jesus's tomb first, but John is the one who believes first in chapter 20. And we're thinking, oh, one's slightly ahead of the other. Or in this chapter, Peter, we saw last week, he may be the one who's first in devotion. Do you remember? He leaps out of the fishing boat. He's the first one to try and get to Jesus. But we saw John is the one who first recognized Jesus and so on. And there's almost a kind of rivalry, competition between them. And then at the end of the gospel, in these final verses, we discover that Peter and John actually have very different callings from their master. So Peter, as we've seen, he's called to be a pastor and a martyr in verses 15 to 19, whereas John is called instead to stay alive, at least for a bit longer, and to be a key witness to Jesus, especially, we're told, in writing this gospel. Verse 24, this is the disciple who is bearing witness about these things and who has written these things. And having seen these different callings, we then, of course, we track back through the gospel and we see how all these differences between Peter and John, this the potential competition even, was really just preparation for their different complementary callings. It's not a rivalry, it's actually a partnership, working on the same team with different roles. And so throughout this gospel, John is presented as the archetypal witness. And we get it hinted at even here in verse 20 in our passage, when John is referred to as the one who had been reclining at table close to Jesus and had said, Lord, who is it that is going to betray you? And the reason we're being reminded of that incident is because that was where it was said of John, back in chapter 13, he then leaned back against Jesus' chest and said, and it's this picture of this special intimacy, this special trust between John and Jesus. And significantly, the same phrase was being deliberately repeated from chapter 1, verse 18, where it was used to describe the special intimacy between the Father and the Son. Do you remember? No one has seen God at any time. The only begotten Son who is in the bosom of the Father, or against the chest of the Father. It's the same phrase. He has declared him. So the point is that just as Jesus can reliably reveal God, he was in the closest possible intimacy with God in eternity, so John can reliably reveal Jesus because of his special closeness with Jesus. He's the beloved disciple. And this suitability that John has to be a witness comes out in lots of other places as well. John uniquely was the only one of the 12 disciples at the cross. So he's in a great position to be a witness to these events. He was even there in the high priest's courtyard, seeing what was happening. And as we saw at the empty tomb, and then again in the fishing boat, he's very perceptive. John correctly grasps what's happening before anyone else does. And then at the end of it all, Jesus, he takes all this. He wonderfully takes John's gift. He takes John's wiring, his situation. And he uses John in a distinctive way to serve the church as a witness. And we see the same if we track through with Peter as well. So throughout this gospel, Peter is the archetypal activist. Do you remember? He's the one who pledges his allegiance to Jesus most loudly. He's the one who draws his sword to defend Jesus. He's the first to stride into the empty tomb. He's the first to leap out of the fishing boat. And so wonderfully, Jesus takes Peter and all his gifts and all his wiring, and Jesus uses Peter in a distinctive way to serve the church. And so this passage is bringing together and showing us how we can recognize and celebrate the distinctive callings which Jesus gives to his people. So in conclusion, we've seen, haven't we, that John is showing us that humble love, that the kind of love which Peter came to express, the kind of love which the gospel produces in us, as each of us comes to Jesus, not as heroes, but as sinners. This humble love also frees us to celebrate one another's distinctive callings. And so when someone is gifted in a way that I'm not, you know, I can do my best, but I'm just never going to have that kind of gifting. Or when someone else is blessed in a way that I'm not, you know, I've always wanted that one thing and now they get it and I don't. The gospel frees us not to feel threatened or not to feel bitter. The gospel frees us to stop seeing life as a competition altogether, with everyone around us as rivals, and to see it as family. And this rivalry outlook is so prevalent, isn't it? I'm old enough now that I've been to some 10-year and now 20-year college reunions. And it's fascinating when you go there, just how we speak about one another. You know, so-and-so's really got ahead since we last saw her. Or she's really pulled away from the pack career-wise. And everything is phrased as though we're in this massive competition. And we have to view everyone we meet as, you know, through this prism of rivals. And it's so wonderful that in Jesus' kingdom, it's different. In Jesus' kingdom, we are invited into a family. And it's a family where we can trust the head of the family completely. He has given each of us different gifts, different challenges. And yet we can trust that he knows exactly what he's doing. And so instead of feeling threatened or resentful, we can start to see those around us as people, people loved by God. And we can start to celebrate their distinctive gifts and callings because they're our brothers and sisters. And that means we can actually start to love one another rather than compete. So we began, didn't we, by thinking about this toxic comparison syndrome. And I hope we can see what a difference Jesus makes in this area. I'm going to leave a bit of time for us to go quiet before the Lord, before our prayers. And it'd be a good time to perhaps repent for some of us, perhaps to think about how this is an issue for us and where we can learn humble love. And then we'll have our prayers in a moment.